And thanks for joining us now on KVCR for KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming, and on this edition of the program, let's welcome Michelle Dowd, local author. Thank you for joining us.
David, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Now, we're going to be talking about your book, Forager, Field Notes for Surviving a Family Cult. And I like starting this way because the title is a wonderful tease, and it just, did you say family cult here? But first, let's get a little bit about you before the book. You teach in the area.
I do. I teach at Chaffey College. So I'm the advisor of student publications. So I oversee our student newspaper, The Breeze, our literary journal, The Chaffey Review, and also a nonfiction magazine called The Baseline.
Nice. And aren't some of the students now working on podcasts as well?
They are, yes.
Excellent.
So student media will also include a little bit of broadcasting, a lot of podcasting, and pretty much any social media stories, TikTok and Threads and other ways that they are practicing getting stories out there in our community. So I teach classes that help them prepare for that, that they get academic credit for. And then I also just run The Breeze, which is a student-run publication, but I'm the advisor and just try to keep up with them, try to encourage them to keep changing and growing.
Nice. And the book now, Forager, Field Notes for Surviving a Family Cult. So I'd like to really start with that not-so-subtle statement of a title and talk about the scenario in which you grew up. So would you differentiate, please, between the field versus the mountain, I suppose?
So in the book, I call it The Fields. It was a property that my grandfather was basically given, I think for a dollar a year or something, by a businessman who thought that my grandfather was doing good things for boys in the community. And so it was a dump where they had literally dumped things. And so my grandfather had many boys, including my father, who cleared out the dump and planted grass and created a field where boys could play snake in the grass and flag football and wrestle, box, do things like that. And eventually they played more organized sports and after-school programs while people were still going to a school. So I was born there, the second of my parents' four children, also the second of my grandfather's 15 grandchildren. My mother was the first to have children. She had the first three. And my grandfather tried very hard not to let anyone in the organization know who was related to him. Everyone called him Grandpa, and so it took me a very long time to understand that he was my mother's father. That was something that was very discreet in the organization. And because of this, my grandfather really tried not to show any favoritism. Now, I'm not saying it didn't exist, but he tried not to let anybody see it. And so our mother didn't have very much money, and we didn't have a place to live. And so he sent us up to the mountain, which is in the Angeles National Forest above Mountain High, kind of above Wrightwood area there. And we lived on only 16 acres, but it was bordered by 700,000 acres that the Angeles National Forest leases out to camps. And especially back in the early days, my grandfather leased it in the 1940s. The WPA had created buildings and things on the mountain, and they were parceling it out for people who could be, quote, responsible to take care of the land and to let kids have after school or summer activities. And so my grandfather got in under that clause back in the early 1940s. And so when we moved up there in 1976, I was a little girl, and we were living in a mess hall created by the WPA and working with an outhouse and all of us in one room. And we started a life without the outside world.
Without the outside world. And this was very much an insular type of setting. You were preparing for the apocalypse and waiting for it, as a matter of fact. Your grandfather was seen as the last prophet, and he would live to be 500 years old, he would say. And he wouldn't even die. He would just be taken up to heaven like Elijah. This was the setting. This was what you were taught to believe and what so many around you believed.
Yes. Yes, and I did indeed believe it.
So your grandfather, your father, and mother were here as well. How many people were actually living on the mountain?
On the mountain, it was just our nuclear family and one young man in his early 20s. He might have been as young as 20, 21, who lived with us. We often had young men from the organization that my grandfather would send up to the mountain to live with us as older brothers. In retrospect, after a little bit of research, they were young men who were struggling at the field, and they needed more supervision. So when we first moved up there, there was only one man living with us, and then my three siblings and my parents. So we were alone up there. However, the boys would come up on spiritual trips where they would come up in a bus and get dropped off there. And my mother and father would teach a group of boys as well. But usually they only stayed for a week or two at a time.
So most of the people that were involved with the organization, they lived down in the valley then, closer to the field. And so the mountain was really for you and the closest part of your family then, yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
We were in a very specific category because we were, you know, God's chosen people.
Okay. So while this book doesn't center around your mother, I mean, this is more the story of a little girl growing up and finding herself and finding out certain things, but she is an integral part of the story. A point that you brought up somewhere, where does her story end and where does mine begin? And I wonder if you could just elaborate on that. There's a lot of metaphoric type things that we'll be addressing in here. I have some very specific scenarios I'll be asking you about, but some of these things, like stepping over a log, for example, I see that as such a metaphoric sense and not the literal, although there's value there as well. So between her story ending and yours beginning, can you elaborate on that just a little bit?
I think our stories are completely intertwined. Mm-hmm. I think even what I have done since I left the organization is very intertwined with my mother. It has a lot to do, I think, with the style of training and the style of education that she was most comfortable with, which is very informal and completely hands-on. And sometimes I look at myself, and as many women do, I think, oh my goodness, I turned into my mother. I don't look like my mother, but I see that I have continued in her line of thinking, except for religion. Mm-hmm. So my mother was, in my opinion, a victim of a system. And she believed in the system like I did. But when she was raised in the system, there was even less opportunity for girls or women in the outside world. And in the organization in which we were raised, which was, I would say, on average, you could say 100 years behind popular culture.
Okay.
So there just weren't a lot of opportunities for women. They were supposed to raise children and obey their husbands. But because my mother was so intelligent and because she was the founder's daughter, she found ways to exist outside the system. And in retrospect, I also see that she trained me to do that, to do the code switching gracefully to some degree. She was able to do it without getting caught. She never raised her voice. She wasn't argumentative. She used to say it was, and I don't agree with this, but she did train me with this. She trained me to never let a man ever think that you're smarter than he is. She said that one of the greatest gifts that you can give a man is to think he is intelligent and to give him things to talk about that he likes to talk about that he thinks that he came up with. So I was raised mostly around men, and she had trained me very well to help men feel good about themselves. She was very good at that. And so she was able to skirt her way through all sorts of situations. And the actual advice she gave for survival training, yes, it is very interesting as metaphor, but it's literal as well. And she was very good at it. And she was training rangers who were up there who had degrees in these things how to do it, because she just couldn't help wherever she was teaching people how to do the things that she knew how to do. And that's just part of her personality.
Your father, there are times that when you speak of him asking questions, his time in the Army, for example, you were asking these questions, and it wasn't his answers that got to me, but rather the fact that he deflected the questions so much. And I think some of it might have been because you were asking, did you ever shoot a person? And maybe some of the questions had to do with that. But was he always like that, or was it just this set of questions?
I don't know if my father's ever answered a question I've asked him my entire life.
Oh, gosh, okay.
He does deflect, so that's very astute that you noticed that. I don't think either of my parents generally answered questions, because if we had become accustomed to getting answers to our questions, we might continue to ask them. And that is something that was and is very dangerous in cult situations. So high control groups, of course, don't want members to ask questions. What they want is members to obey. So we were taught to trust and obey. And whenever I would ask questions, they would be deflected, because eventually, of course, questions lead to more questions, and mm-hmm. the answers then become more and more uncomfortable.
There was definitely a shift between the young girl telling her story to the person who's in her teens, nearing the point of leaving the mountain, becoming a quitter, as they were called. I'd like to hear about how you were even able to write this. I know that there was a point where you were taking notes in the margins of an old Sears catalog and eventually given a journal. How were you able to write this? Between memories and journals? Did you contact other people? How did this happen?
Wonderful questions. I can give you the literal way that I wrote it, but okay. I will take a step back and say, when I decided to write the book, or when the book was actually purchased, or I was given an advance to write it, it took me 4 months to write. But I had done a lot of research prior to that, and I met with many, many members and former members of the organization, including all my siblings. I also had a box of these notes that I had taken as a child, including the original Sears catalog, and including the original bound about 500 sheets, because I kept adding to it with these little strings, 500 sheets of handwritten notes that I had done between the ages probably of 8 and 12, and then a series of other notebooks I kept as a teenager, including some letters that I retrieved that I wrote to the boy we call Luke in the story. And so I had a lot of notes that I went through, a lot of journals that I could read in the actual voice of the child. Wow. And some of the dialogue with my father was taken verbatim from the notebooks as I wrote it. I felt that it was very painful to me to go back and kind of become that young girl, but I also embraced it because I wrote this during COVID and I was in the unique position, even though I was teaching full-time, to be teaching online and to be teaching mostly asynchronously. So I was able to get up early in the morning and I would light a candle and I would write in the dark before anybody else in the household woke up. And I just sort of channeled the inner girl from reading her notes the night before, and then I would come and write the voice that came to me. So especially the first maybe third to half of the book is really in a much younger voice and a voice that's not very well developed. And then as the girl becomes older, her vocabulary becomes more sophisticated as the narrator myself, and I'm able to capture a little bit more of the analytical side. But the young girl wasn't doing analysis. She was just like, let me tell you what my life is like. And I think I was able to do that partly because I was so in touch with the notes as I was reading them. I think it also helped that the box was locked for decades. The box is a box I made as a teenager, and I made it with one of the young men who live with us. His name's Jim, and he was a woodworker, among other things, and he taught me to build the box. And he got me a lock, and he knew I was doing some writing, and it was very kind of him to give me this lock. And we probably purchased the lock when I was 16. And I put it on, and at that point at 16, I had a key. And somewhere when I left, I lost the key, and I toted around this locked wooden box for decades until I wrote this book. So when I pulled all these notes out, I had not looked at them in all those years.
Oh, my gosh.
So that gave me a very fresh look at the girl I was.
Incredibly. If you were 16, you were still there.
Correct.
When this box was made. I'm actually surprised that you would have been allowed to have a box with private things locked away.
I wasn't allowed to.
So where were they buried beneath the rafters somewhere? I mean,
I hid everything. But by the time I was 16, my parents were not very involved in our lives. One of the things this organization did at the time, and I think the first trip was in maybe 1965, so before I was born, before my parents got married, my grandfather would take boys. He first started taking them maybe even as early as the late 50s on these long summer trips, and they would go play mostly baseball, I think, against, I don't know, other communities. They weren't really a school, but they would just like go out and play during the summer.
Okay.
And then eventually they started putting on these little plays, and then the plays developed into bigger plays, and they became very theatrical. And I started acting in these plays when I was 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, and I would go on these trips. As a little teeny kid, I found out recently that I was on one before I was even a year old, and my sister and I were just kind of like tossed in playpens, like, while I don't even know what was happening. But we did that for years, and eventually, as we got a little bit older, our mother didn't want us going on the boys' trips. I think the last boys' trip I went on was when I was 9, and so she would leave. And she would be gone with our
gotcha.
Father and our brother. And so we would just be alone. And we were often alone for the summer when I was 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. So we had gotten kind of used to being without our parents and just being alone on the mountain. And so there was a lot of things that I learned to hide. And I think our mother had a lot better things to do, or she felt she had better things to do than paying attention. She wasn't looking.
You're listening to KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Find many past KVC Arts through iTunes, Spotify, NPR One, and Google Play, and more still at kvcrnews.org/arts. On this edition of the program, I'm speaking with Michelle Dowd, author of Forager, Field Notes for Surviving a Family Cult, a memoir. More at michelledowd.org. And we'll have several other links at the end of the program. Michelle, earlier we spoke of the trips for the boys, but later there were plenty of trips that you were a part of. The trips were evangelical in nature, but they weren't necessarily designed to bring people into the organization.
It was to teach them about God, but also to get money. So we passed a hat. We passed baskets around, and we had these envelopes, and we went to KOAs, and we always asked for donations. So we earned money by doing this. Now, we were told we were saving their souls, but nobody was allowed to join the organization who was an adult. And that's an important distinction between this cult and many other cults. So this family cult, you could be born into the cult like I was, or you could join as a very young child. So the man I married, for example, he joined when he was 7. He was older than I was by many years. So I had access. He's the father of my children. And so he had told me stories for years about his experience, which was much, much different than mine because he joined and his family was not part of it. He has one sister and she wasn't part of the cult. So he joined, and by 10, he was fully, fully committed to my grandfather and all of the teachings. And his parents just let him do it because they believed he was getting a lot of moral training. He was getting athletic training. He was staying out of trouble. They felt that he had purpose to his life. And I don't know. I think that there were a lot of families who felt that letting their boys be in a really kind of military environment was ultimately good for them. And this was in the 1970s when he was a kid. And I think he actually joined maybe as early as 69. I think that's the year that he joined the cult. And, you know, there was a lot going on in the world that some conservative parents didn't want their kids part of. And here was this organization. Everyone was clean cut. Nobody smoked or drank or did things that looked, at least on the outside, as compromising. And so they felt that their boys were getting training in how to be good human beings or good men.
There were a lot of cults in this time period, in the late 60s, going into the 70s, and there was drug use. There was a strong sexual aspect to some of them as well. And so this one, well, it's not like people said, well, this is a good cult. People didn't even see it as a cult. They just saw it as an organization where the boys could receive training of some sort, and they knew it was a strong physical thing, a strong moral thing.
Right. Cults never see themselves as cults, of course. And the people who send people to cults don't see them as cults because, you know, nobody wants their kids inside of cults.
Right.
But there was a sort of uprising in the 1980s where families pulled out their kids, many, many families. Before my grandfather died, I believe it was in 1981 or early 82, a huge group of young people left because parents realized it was a cult. And it almost got completely cleaned out. And then they kind of repopulated it. So it's not to say that it wasn't recognizable. It just wasn't easily recognizable as a cult.
Especially,
and there was a great deal of covert, like all the young people were trained not to tell their parents what were going on. And when they would go on these trips, they were not allowed to call their parents. And parents understood that there would never be a phone call. And the trips were generally 10 weeks. You send your boy off for 10 weeks and you don't hear from him. Now, there were some letters that were allowed to be exchanged, but those letters were all read before the boys received them and before the boys could send them. So there was no money. Boys did not have money. They had script and they could give credit. Like, so if they wanted to write something, they could give it to a leader and the leader would decide, kind of like in prison, whether or not that letter could be sent.
And then
the leader would send it, not the boy. The boy didn't have access to stamps or to money to buy those things. And so all of that was very controlled, and there was a lot of propaganda. And then you were given a script about what you could or couldn't say to authorities. And parents were considered authorities. They were considered heathens and outsiders. And you were told the same thing. You weren't allowed to talk to any sort of law enforcement or a teacher or a pastor. Like, you couldn't talk to anybody on the outside. And if they confronted you, there was a script of what you could say.
Gotcha. Oh, my gosh. And so now I read the book, but I think I still pictured, I guess I'm just now realizing that a lot of kids still lived at home And they would just come to the field or come to some of the events or some of the practices or whatever.
Well, it was very rigid. And so, again, the children who were born there lived there on the bank of the field.
Okay.
And then the boys who were brought in and eventually some girls who were brought in, it was almost like a pyramid scheme. Like, they would compete to be part of it. And then as they started getting older, so like, you couldn't be into what was considered high school, like teenage years, without being chosen. And so there was younger kids who were honestly learning tackle football at age 5. And they were doing all those things. And then by the age of 14, you either had to be all in. You could not go to school. They allowed you to go to school through 8th grade. But after that, you could not go. You couldn't be on the property if you went to school somewhere else. You had to devote yourself completely. And then you would be required, of course, to go on these trips. So you'd be separated from your family. And you'd be required to go up to the mountain, too, and learn the survival training. And you'd be required to be separated from your family for those activities as well. So that by the time you were 18, if you wanted to stay and you wanted to be at the field at all, you had to sign a commitment for life form. And then every single minute of your life was clearly dictated. And the book doesn't go into all of this, because it's told from the perspective of a girl who didn't understand that there was anything unusual about this. And so she didn't see all the details. All she saw was the result, which is that she didn't make any new friends. The people that were in her life were the people that had been there all along. From the beginning. There was no new people in her world.
So after eighth grade then, would have been homeschooling then, I guess? Or how did they get around the whole state laws requiring a certain education?
Well, you know, back in the day, state laws were pretty loose about these kind of things.
Okay,
I mean,
okay.
I didn't have a social security number or things like that. It was not ever considered homeschooling. But my mother actually, right after her father died, so when my grandfather died, my mother took over the school. They had just kind of nebulously called it a school before, and they just played sports, and they didn't actually do any school at all. But then my mother started an actual school, and by the time she had been there for a few years, she got it accredited. Okay. And so at that point, it was just a very, very conservative, private school.
Okay.
But when I was a kid, my mother never sat down once in my life and said, here's a book. Read it. Or here's how you write the alphabet. So she wasn't doing those kind of things. But we did learn because we went, at least when I was a little teeny kid, we went to school, my sisters and I. My youngest sister only went till kindergarten. I went through second grade. And my older sister went through third grade at public school. And then nobody at the organization who was born there ever went to school after that again. Because they realized, of course, if you let kids go to secular schools, you're not going to be able to keep them sequestered.
Let's talk about the roles that people played and gendered roles. The boys were brought up to be strong. There was the football and the fighting, or let's say boxing and that kind of a thing. But really it came down to, I think I read this almost literally here, knowing who the toughest was and always knowing which kid might have been tougher and all that kind of a thing. But the girls, were they completely brought up to just be simply a someday you will take care of a husband? Or did they even go that deep into it? Was it just simply obedience?
It was obedience. And my grandfather could change his mind anytime he wanted because he never wrote anything down. Mm. He was mercurial. So in any mood, he could ban anyone for any reason whatsoever. It was started as completely as a boys' organization. The girls who came to the organization eventually were the sisters of the boys who were in the organization. Mm. And nobody was allowed to get married until 1966 when my parents got married. They were the very first marriage. Mm. Before that, boys only stayed if they were willing to be celibate. And so then they would stay as men in the organization who would just follow my grandfather, which some men did. One of the brothers, he lived to be 90. He took over after my grandfather. And I don't know if he was really celibate his whole life, but it was declared he was celibate his whole life. And so they were the ones who followed him since the 1930s, and they agreed not to get married. They agreed not to have children. It was much more like Catholic priests. And then when my mom came along, I don't think my grandfather, her father, wanted her to be, quote, an old maid or a spinster. And so he felt he needed to marry her off to one of his boys. So he married her off to this big, strong boy in his 20s. My father was in his late 20s at this point. But my dad was the first man allowed to get married there. There just weren't families there before the late 1960s.
Okay. I'm going to talk about a moment in the book, but then sort of the conceptual fallout from that. There's a point where you're gathering boulders to make an irrigation system. Okay, and your mother leaves, and it seems like almost right away, your natural, automatic, and perhaps immediate response is to start surveying the area and assessing the situation. thinking about what you can eat, a potential water supply, the fact that your sister knows Morse code, things like this. This was automatically happening for you, but I wonder about when you noticed this was happening, that you would immediately take stock as soon as you were presented with some situation. You know, you probably did it all the time, but at some point you had to have realized you're getting yourself ready no matter what situation you were in. How old were you?
I don't think I had any idea that I did that until I was in college.
Oh, okay.
Well, in college. I still do that. I think it was very, very strongly trained into me. And it just was second nature to always be worried. First of all, I thought the second coming was coming any moment, and I was very alert for that. But there was also, we were in a lot of dangerous situations, and even the danger we were taught was danger, which is that some outsider might want to talk to us. Right. We always had to find an escape route. And so, especially as a very young child, I used to sell candy and tickets and things to earn money on the streets. And it was very, very important never to let an authority know what your real name was or where you were from. And so we got, I just feel like probably since I was 3 years old, probably I was taught to always, always be on the lookout and to always survey what was around me.
Okay.
And then eventually when it became to literal survival training, it's an interesting skill set to be aware, to understand your environment. It's very interesting to me how many people never look at their environment that I've met in my civilian life out here, you know, who just aren't aware and they wouldn't have any idea what to eat. And so it's kind of been a party trick, I think, for my life on the outside to show people what they can eat. And I did a training actually once at Chafee for faculty where I did this exercise where it was for critical thinking, you know, across the curriculum or whatever. But I said, okay, a plane went down. We're all in these groups. Here's what is in the plane. What would you take out? You have only this much space, you know, one of those activities.
Right.
And what would you choose? And I gave them a handout so they'd know what the options were that were inside the plane and then give the reason of why you would choose that. And then I walked them through why those were ridiculous choices, you know, and what should you take if you only could carry what you could take on your person. Just a lot of things that I think I never thought were useful. I don't think now that I need to know how to survive the apocalypse, but I do think it's useful to be resourceful, to,
Absolutely.
You know, be resilient.
For this edition of KVC Arts, I've been speaking with Michelle Dowd, author of Forager, Field Notes for Surviving a Family Cult, a memoir. We'll have more with Michelle on the next KVC Arts. In the meantime, more on the book at michelledowd.org. Michelle's on Instagram at michelledowdz. There's also mdowd.substack.com. The book is available in hardback, paperback, Kindle, and audio, anywhere books are sold, and all are on Amazon. Thanks again to Michelle Dowd, and here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Tony Lopez, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. Many past KVC Arts can be found through iTunes, Spotify, NPR One, and Google Play. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.